America Looks Abroad. This is the 50th in a series of broadcasts presented by the staff members of the Foreign Policy Association, a nonpartisan organization which offers accurate information on world affairs. Today's subject is New Bases for American Defense. The speaker is Mr. A. Randall Elliott, Research Associate of the Foreign Policy Association. Mr. Elliott.
Thank you. During the course of this war, all of the great powers, with the sole exception of France, have reached out to acquire and fortify new strategic bases outside their domestic territory. Reports from Washington and South America this week indicating that the United States has arrived at general understandings with most of the Latin American republics for the use of air and naval bases to the south show that this country has not ignored the recent military experience of Europe. The increased range and striking power of aerial bombers have forced abandonment of plans for static defense, such as France's reliance on its Maginot Line to protect French soil. In the modern war of movement, the best defense, paradoxically, is the ability to take the offensive when necessary. National security now demands, as never before, strategic outposts from which the enemy can be engaged before he is able to approach and establish himself on home territory. As you may have noticed, Great Britain is now trying to persuade the Irish government to grant Britain naval bases in Erin, and for the past 3 months our own government has been actively interested in obtaining new bases on three fronts, in the Atlantic, Latin America, and the Pacific. In a somber speech before the House of Commons on Tuesday, Prime Minister Churchill emphasized Britain's need for air and naval bases in the south and west coasts of Ireland, primarily to safeguard British sea lanes. After the World War, the British Admiralty considered that it would be difficult and perhaps impossible to feed and defend Britain in time of war without using the bases at Berehaven, Cove, and Lough Swilly, and the government retained its control over these three ports under the Treaty of 1921, through which Britain granted dominion status to the Irish Free State. In 1938, however, London surrendered its bases in Erin as part of a general Anglo-Irish settlement. And 3 days ago, Irish Premier De Valera told a cheering Dáil Éireann, or Irish Chamber of Deputies, that so long as Erin remains neutral, there can be no question of handing over these ports. He added significantly that if Britain or any other belligerent tried to bring pressure to bear on his government, the attempt would only lead to bloodshed. In the face of this pointed warning, Britain must defend its vital shipping against the increased toll of a new German submarine campaign without the use of defense positions in Erin. Meanwhile, German planes continued to bomb Britain from the new Nazi bases in France, Belgium, and Holland, while air bombers, surface warships, and submarines, operating from the captured Atlantic bases, have begun the most destructive series of attacks suffered by British merchant vessels during this war. In the past few months, Britain's daily shipping losses have been twice as large as those incurred between the outbreak of war in September 1939 and France's surrender last June. They are still only half as great as the drastic losses inflicted in April 1917, when Germany's unrestricted submarine campaign in the World War brought Britain within 3 weeks of starvation. But now, Britain requires considerably more shipping than ever before, since it must obtain all of its requirements of food and other essentials from America, Africa, the Near East, and the Orient, whereas a good share of its needs normally came from the European continent now under Axis domination. This week, Germany extended the radius of its intensive sea warfare along Britain's lengthy supply lines. Last Tuesday, a British-Canadian convoy was successfully attacked in mid-Atlantic by a German raider of the Graf Spee type, possibly one of the pocket battleships Admiral Scheer or Lutzow, and Berlin claimed that in the engagement, the convoy of 15 to 20 vessels and 86,000 tons had been sunk. At the same time, German Stuka dive bombers were said to have sunk 8 other ships, aggregating over 30,000 tons. And yesterday, the German High Command announced the sinking of 8 additional British merchant vessels totaling 43,000 tons. The British Admiralty has denied that the entire convoy was sunk on Tuesday and has not confirmed the extent of other losses announced from Berlin. But no matter how accurate the German claims may be, it is clear that Britain's shipping problem has now become critical. Unless the British can check the German raids promptly, Germany may succeed in blockading Britain and wear down British resistance through siege, rather than undertake a costly invasion of the Isles. The threat to Britain also involves a threat to America. Since the United States does not yet have the two-ocean navy authorized by Congress a few months ago, we face the dilemma of either leaving the waters near one of our coasts relatively undefended, or seriously weakening our protective strength by dividing our naval forces about equally between the Atlantic and the Pacific. Sound naval strategy in this country dictates that most of the fleet operate as a unit, so that weaker enemies cannot attack isolated portions of it one at a time until the entire fleet is disabled or sunk. In recent years, the United States has been free to concentrate most of its fighting units in the Pacific, chiefly because of two facts. A friendly British Navy dominated the Atlantic, and in case of any emergency, the Panama Canal enabled us to move our own naval forces rapidly into the Atlantic. Since June, however, German successes against the British have challenged British predominance in the Atlantic and thereby exposed our own Panama Canal to attack. To forestall the possibility that potential enemies might gain access to our domestic coasts or attack the canal, the United States government 2 months ago traded the 50 overage destroyers to Britain in return for 8 naval and air bases on British territory in this hemisphere. United States naval authorities at present are surveying sites for the bases, and this morning 27 engineering experts landed at Bermuda to supervise preliminary work on the first of the defense outposts to be constructed. The new United States bases at Newfoundland and Bermuda will be most important for guarding the vital industrial regions of our eastern seaboard. They will strengthen our Atlantic coast defenses by extending the radius of our naval and air action, by serving as repair and fueling stations for our Atlantic patrols, and by eliminating the possibility that enemy forces may occupy these strategic islands and establish offensive bases near our shores. Newfoundland is on the shortest Great Circle air route between New York and London, and it was there that Marshal Balbo, the Italian, first landed on his memorable mass flight from Italy to the Chicago World's Fair. The island now has the world's second-largest airport at Hattie's Camp, newly completed, and many of its excellent harbors could shelter the entire American fleet. One of these, Placentia Bay, faces our shoreline to the south and is ice-free the year-round. Bermuda, 700 miles from both Boston and New York City, occupies a position comparable with that of Hawaii in the Pacific, and is unexcelled in strategic value by any island off our eastern coast. Bermuda lies on the southern route across the Atlantic and is used by the transatlantic clippers on their regular hops from New York to Lisbon, Portugal. Britain has maintained a naval base and cruiser dockyard at Bermuda for many years, and the United States will presumably be free to use some of these facilities as well as to construct new ones of our own. In the Atlantic, in the Caribbean area, that part of the Atlantic, the country acquired new sites for bases in the Bahamas, at Jamaica, Antigua, St. Lucia, Trinidad, and British Guiana. Britain used to maintain a Caribbean naval station at Kingston, Jamaica, but at present there are virtually no defenses in any of these colonies. Consequently, it will require many months to fortify them for naval and air use, and to construct the necessary dry docks, machine shops, barracks, and other military establishments. In time, however, these strategic bases will greatly reinforce our present defense outposts at Guantanamo, Cuba, San Juan and Culebra, Puerto Rico, and St. Thomas in the Virgin Islands. For the first time, our defenses will guard all Caribbean approaches to the Panama Canal, from the South Atlantic as well as from the North. Extending like a large bow from Florida to the northeast coast of South America, they form a continuous line of bases which can be readily supplied along interior lines of communication. 3 weeks ago, the United States Navy began its preliminary winter maneuvers in the Caribbean, and is devoting special attention this year to conditioning the Navy and the Marines for tropic and subtropic warfare. Although only sketchy reports of the maneuvers have appeared in this country, the operations apparently extend to the new Caribbean bases obtained from Britain. And incidentally, they afford an excellent opportunity for United States naval authorities to maintain close watch on the French island of Martinique. Ever since France surrendered in June this year, 100 American-made warplanes, originally consigned for France, have been kept at Martinique, along with the 22,000-ton French aircraft carrier Bayonne, other French warships, and gold bullion and coins valued at between $200 million and $500 million. The uncertainty surrounding Franco-German relations since the armistice of June 22nd has led to considerable anxiety in America lest the French island be used as a shield for German military or subversive political activity in this hemisphere. Early last month, the Vichy government announced its intentions to begin elaborate improvements on the French naval base at Fort de France, Martinique. But the plan was quickly dropped after a United States government spokesman in Washington expressed their disapproval. 2 weeks ago, President Roosevelt asked the Vichy government for information regarding any change in its attitude toward the war, and Secretary Hull indicated that the United States had threatened to occupy Martinique under provisions of the Havana Agreement with the other 20 American republics in case of close collaboration between Germany and France. This week, Marshal Henri Philippe Pétain replied to President Roosevelt in a communication which has not yet been made public. The note probably contains assurances similar to those given by the French ambassador in Washington, who is said to have told this government that France does not intend to go to war against Great Britain, to turn over its fleet to Germany, or permit any of the belligerents to use French colonial bases, and that consequently there would be no justification for any American intervention in Martinique. On the basis of his talks with Secretary Hull and Sumner Welles, French Ambassador Henri Haye has expressed his full confidence that the United States will not intervene in any of the French colonies. There the matter rests, but the situation at Martinique and nearby Guadeloupe remains tense, as United States warships and planes continue to patrol the surrounding waters daily. After the United States acquired the 8 naval and air bases from Britain, Secretary Hull formally notified the Latin American governments that they were free to cooperate fully with this country in using the new outposts. Army and Navy staff officers from most of the American republics have consulted in Washington during the past month, and now it's reported that they are actually selecting bases throughout Latin America to be developed for strengthening joint defense. Secretary Hull has said and again expressed the point yesterday that there is no intention to transfer ownership of the sites chosen, nor will this country lease the bases as in the deal with Great Britain. Rather, the Latin American governments themselves will apparently construct the required bases, and perhaps with technical and financial assistance from the United States. They will then permit, apparently, all of the countries in this hemisphere to use the sites for their common protection. In the Pacific, the United States is also interested in new bases. In mid-September, Secretary of the Navy Knox approved a comprehensive statement of American naval policy, calling for greater mobility in strategic operations, an adequate supply service, and the development of air and other essential bases for the support of naval operations. 2 weeks earlier, Mr. Knox had announced that negotiations were in progress with Ecuador and Costa Rica to obtain rights for the construction and use of bases in the Galapagos and Cocos Islands, which are within 1,000 miles of the Pacific entrance to the Panama Canal and would greatly strengthen canal defenses on that side. Moreover, late in September, a Senate resolution was introduced to authorize the President to enter negotiations with Britain for acquisition or lease of British island bases in the Pacific. 3 days ago, London reported that the United States, Britain, and Australia have agreed in principle on the use of such bases, as well as on general defense cooperation in that ocean. In Washington, the State Department affirmed that cooperations are proceeding among the three governments, but said that no decisions have as yet been reached. The most important locations concerned are the powerful British stronghold at Singapore Island, just off the Malay Peninsula, and the base at Port Darwin, on the northern coast of Australia. Any final decision on these and other new bases in the Pacific, as was formerly true in the case of Atlantic and Latin American bases, we'll have to wait for a clear formulation of United States foreign policy with regard to the region concerned. In the meantime, this country is busily consolidating its recent strategic gains and is prepared to share with Latin America the task of defending this hemisphere against aggression from abroad.
Mr. A. Randall Elliott, Research Associate of the Foreign Policy Association, was today's speaker in the series America Looks Abroad. If you would like a free copy of this talk, address your request to the Foreign Policy Association, number 22 East 38th Street, New York City, or in care of the station to which you are listening. The Foreign Policy Association is a nonpartisan organization open to all who are interested in foreign affairs. In the world of today, foreign affairs are your affairs. We invite you to tune in next Sunday to hear another speaker in the series America Looks Abroad. This is the National Broadcasting Company.